Scientists are racing to develop strains of super rice. The idea is to prevent deadly famines. Researchers say tough, highly productive rice plants offer the best hope for feeding a world population that will reach 9 billion by 2050. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, the quest to create super rice is producing a lot of scientific papers on rice genetics.
In the rice fields of northern Bangladesh, farmers like to say rice is life. And since the 1960s, rice crops here have been getting better and better. These farmers in the Rangpur district say that's changed everything for them.
30 to 40 years back, people used to die because of starvation, but they don't see people dying because of starvation now.
It's not just Bangladesh. Across Asia, famines have all but disappeared thanks to genetically superior rice plants. Bob Ziegler directs the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. He says things changed when scientists found out how to breed rice plants that put their energy into making more rice grains rather than longer stalks.
It's essentially doubled rice production in Asia. And what it has allowed is for food supplies in Asia to grow faster, or at least as fast as, population. So we've averted the famines.
But rice production will have to double again by 2050 to keep up with demand. That will mean creating plants that can thrive despite floods, droughts, and disease. Ziegler says these qualities aren't easy to breed into a plant.
Fortunately, in rice, we're in a situation where, with rice having its genome sequenced, the first crop species to have its genome sequenced, with a lot of molecular biological tools at our disposal, we're able for the first time to actually breed for these much more difficult traits.
Scientists describe new ways to do that in three leading scientific journals this week. One study looks at so-called deepwater rice. Rens Vushnik from Utrecht University in the Netherlands says these plants have evolved several ways to solve the problem of rising floodwaters.
One of the solutions is that the plant starts to grow very fast in such a way that parts of the shoot will be above the water level so that that part can function as a sort of a snorkel.
Unfortunately, the snorkel plants don't produce much rice. But in the journal Nature this week, a team from Japan offers a solution to that problem, too. Vojnik says the team identified genes called snorkel 1 and snorkel 2 that control the so-called elongation response in these plants.
By knowing how this elongation is brought about, we can cross them with high-yielding varieties and combine the capacity to elongate with much higher yields than you would normally expect based on the deep-water rice varieties.
A second study from Japan, this one in the journal Science, identifies a gene that helps rice plants resist something called rice blast. Blast is a fungus so devastating to crops that the U.S. considered using it as a biological weapon against Japan during World War II. In the past, plants bred to resist the fungus produced rice that didn't taste good. But the Japanese team says its genetic discovery should make it possible to combine resistance and good taste.
It's a great day for rice genetics.
Susan McCooch of Cornell University says this is precisely the sort of research that could head off famines. And she says rice genetics could help improve the quality of rice as well as the quantity. McCooch has a paper of her own in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It describes the origin of fragrance in rice, specifically the fragrance conferred by a gene called BAD-H2.
Fragrance may sound like a luxurious and maybe a slightly less than vital characteristic, but it costs nothing to breed it in.
And that's possible now that scientists have found the fragrance gene. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Scientists have moved one step closer to building life from scratch. The scientists in question work in the lab of Craig Venter, who's a pioneer of genetic research. In this week's issue of the journal Science, they describe their latest efforts, and NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports.
I've always thought that to bring something inanimate to life, you need a castle, a lightning storm, and a mad scientist.
It's alive!
But it turns out all you really need is an office building in suburban Maryland.
Good afternoon, Venter Institute. May I help you?
Some lab space and these guys.
My name is Sanjay Vashi.
And I'm John Glass, professor in the synthetic biology department.
Judging by their polo shirts and tidy haircuts, these two aren't mad scientists, but they are very, very close to creating life from scratch. It's not quite as crazy as it sounds. The basic blueprint for life is written in molecules known as DNA.
It's a long molecule that's made up of carbon, phosphorus, oxygen, and nitrogen, I think. And hydrogen, of course. Duh.
Yeah, duh. These five elements make up the genomes of every living thing, and scientists can decode an existing genome by looking at the DNA one segment at a time. It's a bit like taking beads off a string. To make new life, John Glass reverses the process.
Now, instead, we're adding new beads onto a string to make what we want.
His goals are modest compared to Dr. Frankenstein's. Glass's group wants to build the genome of a simple bacteria and get it working. He says that could reveal a lot about what makes life, well, alive.
We're trying to understand how life works. What is in these organisms that makes this bag of chemicals be more than a bag of chemicals?
The group already knows how to build a genome. They use a yeast cell as a kind of factory. The yeast strings together pieces of synthetic DNA. But to make the synthetic genome spring to life, Vashi says they need to put it into a bacterial cell.
We needed to put it together.
That's not so easy. Yeast is a fungus, and the bacteria's immune system attacks foreign genetic material. The team has now solved that problem, though. They figured out how to shut down the bacterial defenses. Glass says that they tested it by transplanting a non-synthetic genome from yeast into a bacterial cell.
Now think of it as I took the software from one computer. Now I took that software and I put it into another kind of computer. A different kind of cell.
It worked. They still have to try with a synthetic genome, but even so, Drew Endy of Stanford University says that this provides the last step needed for synthetic life.
All the steps in the process have been demonstrated, and that's the significant thing, right? It means that anybody in the world could begin the good work of trying to figure out how living organisms work or use the same tools to make useful new things.
Researchers want to eventually build bacteria that can clean up pollution or generate biofuels. Of course, the bacteria could be used for harm as well, but Drew Endy says that's how it goes with all technology.
We could all choose to go to the hardware store and purchase hammers, and instead of doing something useful with those hammers, we could hit people directly and hurt folks.
All the scientists involved hope that the creation of the first synthetic life will spark a healthy public debate. But that debate won't involve Frankenstein's monster. Even with all their skill, these scientists can only build a genome that's 6,000 times smaller than ours. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
When we burn fossil fuels, we're not just putting carbon dioxide into the air. A lot of it goes into the sea. And there, carbon dioxide turns into carbonic acid.
As a result, the oceans are becoming more corrosive. Biologists say that's bad for corals, oysters, and other shell-building animals. And scientists are just starting to realize that ocean acidification could affect many other forms of sea life as well. To wrap up our series, Oceans at Risk, NPR's Richard Harris has this report from California's Monterey Bay.
It's comical to watch 600-pound sea lions in the harbor at Moss Landing, California. They jostle, spar, and try to cram themselves onto docks that can barely hold their weight.
It must be pup season because there are numerous youngsters out there, you can see.
Eric Payne looks on approvingly at what seems to be part of a Pacific success story. Up and down the coast, biologists see healthy populations of marine mammals, fish, and other wildlife. But as we head into his laboratory at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, Payne's outlook about the future of life in the sea takes a dark turn. His budding career as a marine biologist is framed by an ominous trend. Civilization is venting carbon dioxide from our tailpipes, smokestacks, and chimneys at a prodigious rate.
And that CO2, at least a third of it so far, has actually ended up in our oceans. So, which is sort of good and bad news in that it's prevented more CO2 from accumulating in the atmosphere, but unfortunately, it comes at a price, and that CO2 going to the ocean leads to it being acidified.
Acidity is measured on the pH scale. Already, the oceans are a tenth of a unit more acidic, and by the end of the century, pH will change by half a unit. But don't be fooled by these modest-sounding numbers.
So we say, only half a unit. What's the big deal about that? You know, That's a tripling of acidity. I mean, that's a threefold increase.
Over the past half dozen years, marine biologists studying ocean acidification have focused mostly on the animals they assume will be the most vulnerable, such as coral reefs and shellfish. If acid levels in the ocean get too high, their shells can literally dissolve. Eric Payne is part of a second wave of research on ocean acidification, that is, biologists trying to understand the consequences for all the life in the sea.
Right now, we're scrambling, and we're trying to get our feet underneath us, and we're trying to basically address the simplest issues is to figure out what is the organism response, also deal with simple ecosystem responses.
So do you have critters growing in your lab? Can you?
We do. We're trying to, at this point, basically get as many animals as we can across the spectrum of invertebrates, vertebrates, all we can get to, basically, get them in the laboratory and expose them to these different scenarios of CO2.
His lab is focusing on animals that live in relatively deep water. That makes sense because they live surprisingly nearby. There's an enormous underwater canyon just offshore, slicing through Monterey Bay.
We've got gastropods, marine snails. We've had brachiopods. We've worked with decapod crabs, basically crustacea, hoping to get some smaller fish in down in our seawater lab facility.
Eric Payne leads us over to a lab bench. 3-inch-long marine snails sit in a glass dish.
So these are Neptunia that we've drilled a hole through the top of the shell, basically, so we can repetitively stick a needle through that hole and draw a sample of blood out.
Where did this critter come from?
These guys came from 700 meters right in the bottom of the canyon, right offshore in the Monterey Canyon.
Each animal they want to study presents different challenges, whether it's getting a blood sample from a snail or figuring out how to keep deep-sea fish alive in the lab. It's also not always so obvious what effects to look for. A change in acid can actually impose a subtle energy tax on marine animals. They already use some energy, pumping acid out of their cells to maintain a healthy pH. As the oceans get more acidic, Payne says they'll expend more energy to maintain that balance.
You're going to have less energy available for the important things, growing, reproducing. We're going to be looking at fecundity, amount of offspring produced, health of offspring produced, and then try to extrapolate into a long-term approach what that's going to do to these ecosystems that we know.
It's too early to say just yet what this portends for life at sea, up to and including the fat and happy sea lions down on the dock.
I think at the least we can say there's going to be profound changes in ocean ecosystems. From there, where we go and the judgments we make about that, you know, perhaps is an issue for further on. But
people think marine biology sounds really exciting. Your career almost sounds depressing.
In a way. And I mean, within a few years, there's going to be change, basically, and I'm not sure how it's going to work out. Now you've depressed me.
There are just a few people in the world who have actually been thinking about ocean acidification for decades, and one of those is down the hall from Eric Payne. Peter Brewer realized that something was amiss with the ocean's chemistry back in the 1960s, and he's seen the problem grow much, much worse.
The quantity of carbon dioxide we've put in the ocean is now well over 500 billion tons, and you can't just transfer that much mass without making changes in the physical properties as well as the biological properties.
Brewer says the carbon dioxide has already altered ocean chemistry in such a way that it affects the way sound travels through the ocean. That effect will grow as more and more carbon dioxide ends up in the sea.
Sound will travel further and noise levels will rise as a strange result of ocean acidification.
What consequences does that have?
Nobody's that sure. It will be about, say, a 40% change by the middle of this century from the pre-industrial signal. One assumes that whales, which communicate at these frequencies, will sense this effect. Whether they will adapt their communication patterns, one does not know.
Scientists may simply have to wait and watch to see how that unintentional experiment evolves. But Brewer doesn't have to wait to see what rising acid levels will do to ecosystems at the bottom of the sea.
Peter,
this is an apparatus we're going to put on the seafloor.
The scientific instrument that's under construction has a green metal frame, bigger than a car, with plexiglass wings that can unfurl underwater. One of the technicians is sitting right in the middle of the machine where a test chamber will be.
We're trying to get the cameras in?
Yeah. Cameras in the strobe for imaging the seafloor area in here.
And then we fly down and we can put some animals in there, add some carbon dioxide. It will flow through the chamber. We can create a change and we can observe behavior and make measurements.
Studying animals on the seafloor would, after all, be a more realistic experiment than a lab study, presuming they can get the instrument to do a good job of simulating future ocean conditions. It'll probably take another year to sort out the technical challenges of getting this instrument to work well. And while those problems seem solvable, Brewer ponders the enormous societal problems that created ocean acidity in the first place.
We're all in a bind here, you know. It's going to be very hard to maintain this number of people on the planet and not have these problems. It worries me that scientists sound the alarm but don't come up with solutions. We're going to have to try.
Technology has revolutionized ocean science during Brewer's career. He can only hope that it will also revolutionize the way we produce energy before the oceans suffer irreparable harm. Richard Harris, NPR News.
If you head far north, almost to the North Pole, you might find unicorns. Well, actually, unicorns of the sea. Narwhals, a kind of whale. The male narwhal has a long, spiral tusk. And for centuries, these tusks were passed off as unicorn horns and prized for their magic powers. These days, biologists are trying to study narwhals, but they can be as elusive as their mythical cousins. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce traveled to northwest Greenland for this report.
One quiet evening, not too long ago, Kristen Lydra was standing on a rocky beach, peering out across a fjord filled with icebergs. The water looked strangely still under the nighttime sun.
It's great conditions for seeing narwhals. They're so sneaky, but they can't really hide when the sea is like a mirror.
A small group of narwhals moved past a glacier that spilled down from the Greenland ice cap. Their path left a shimmering trail in the water.
They're swimming away from the nets.
Really? You can tell that from here?
Yeah, they seem to be swimming towards the other side right now.
Kristen Lydra has been coming to this fjord for the last 8 years. Again and again, she's tried to catch a narwhal by setting up giant nets. This shouldn't be impossible. She and her colleagues have done it in other places.
We definitely can catch them in nets in Greenland and in Canada, in many places in Canada, but here, we haven't managed to do it.
Even though in summer, thousands of narwhals live here in Englefield-Brenning Fjord. Still, she keeps trying. Because if she could briefly snag a narwhal, she could attach a sturdy satellite transmitter to its back. For months, it would send all kinds of information. Where the narwhal goes, how deep it dives. The narwhal has long been famous for its unicorn horn. It's thought to be the whale version of a peacock's tail or a lion's mane. But most of the narwhal's life is a mystery, hidden by darkness and ice.
The main reason that narwhals are not studied is that it's not very easy. They live in this, totally extreme environment where half the year it's completely dark and minus 30 and covered in ice, and the whales are 200 kilometers offshore, and nobody in their right mind would make an expedition to study them.
Then, in the summer,
they're completely skittish and shy from humans, and so you have to wait days before you might even see a narwhal. I mean, days, weeks.
And so she waits, and waits. For 2 weeks in July, she heads up a little camp on this remote, rocky beach. There's a few tents, a couple of colleagues from Denmark, plus 5 Inuit hunters from a nearby town. 24 hours a day, someone keeps watch on big white floats that will bob and jerk if a narwhal swims in the nets. Kristen Lydra says if that happens, she'll pull on a survival suit and rush towards the water to get her hands on the narwhal so she can tag it. In other places, when she's managed to do this, it's been intense.
It's struggling, and it's trying to get free, and it's trying to get untangled, and it wants to come up for air, and it's going up, and it's diving.
Is it like a fish? Does it feel slippery?
Kind of like an inner tube, a little bit. Hard inner tube. I mean, their breath isn't that great. They have whale breath. Kind of a heavy, little bit blubbery smell.
In this fjord, she can see and even hear the narwhal's spout, but only from far away. There's nowhere to go, nothing to do. For days, we sit around and stare at the blue sky, the blue water, and icebergs. Lots of icebergs, some of them bigger than houses. They drift by like clouds. Kristen Lydra watches with a colleague, partly to make sure none of them are headed for the nets.
It's a lot easier to catch icebergs. Maybe we should change fields.
Yes.
Did it ever occur to you?
We could even tag them and see where they're going.
That's a great idea.
This is not what Kristen Lydra expected to be doing with her life. Her dream was ballet.
I trained intensively through high school, and then I went and I danced with a ballet company in Seattle.
But then she had an injury, so she went to college and now has a research job at the University of Washington. She thinks ballet was actually good training for studying narwhals.
You learn how to be miserable and suffer, and like, you just have to keep going for the sake of what you're doing.
One night, everything is suddenly covered by a white mist. The hunters have to take in the nets. As the fog lifts, but before the nets go back out, the narwhals appear, frolicking in front of the glacier, totally out of reach. To pass the time, Kristen Lydra decides to decorate a plywood sign that's lying around. Under the name of the Greenland Institute of Natural Resources, which supports this project, there's the black outline of a narwhal. She picks up a paintbrush. So while you're painting this narwhal white, let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
Have you ever read Moby Dick?
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like Captain Ahab?
I feel worse. like I'm in pursuit of something impossible and elusive, and yeah, I approach it with a very fatalistic attitude, or very realistic attitude with a good sense of humor. Not expecting too much.
Then, 2 days before she has to leave, the narwhals come into view. Kristen Lydra joins two hunters at the top of a hill and peers through binoculars.
This is a good chance.
The backs of the narwhals glisten. They're near shore, moving slowly. She runs down to the beach, pulls out her box of satellite transmitters, and struggles into a red survival suit.
I think it's really close. It's the closest we've come in a really long time. After all these years, I don't usually put my suit on unless I, like, really believe it. There might be a chance.
She's quiet and tense, watching the narwhal. They move towards the nets. Then they veer slightly and slip away.
It looked good. It really looked good, but they play the same trick.
We'll just cook dinner and forget our sorrows.
She takes off her suit and starts making dinner, but that night in her tent, she hardly sleeps, waking every hour to check the nets. When she does drift off, narwhals swim into her dreams. One beaches itself by her tent. Another is strangely tiny, like a salamander at her feet.
But for various reasons, I still couldn't tag them. They were really weird dreams. And then I woke up and then I thought, I think it might be time to go home.
The nets are pulled out onto the rocky shore. Everything gets packed into a permanent tent for storage. It's locked up. And the plywood sign with the painted narwhal is screwed over the front door. And Kristen Lydra says she hopes to come back next year to try again. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.